There is, of course, all the difference in the world between something being taken and something being given. If you have something that is, by its very nature, intended to be something that is given, but it is in turn taken, it changes the very essence of that thing itself, does it not? For example, friendship. Is there even a way to really take friendship? Doesn't that have to be given? Because if it's taken, somehow it's something other than friendship, isn't it? What about a birthday gift? You get that bright, shiny new kazoo you've always wanted for your birthday. It's given to you. But if, instead of it being given to you, you take it, we'll be glad to visit you in jail. Because that's an entirely different thing. What about sexual intimacy? A wonderful gift of God designed to be given in the context of marriage between a man and a woman. But if it's taken, whether by sheer physical force or by emotional and mental manipulation, there's another word for that. And it makes it another thing. See, there's all the difference in the world between something being given and something being taken. Well, the Bible tells us that Jesus' life was not taken from him, but that he gave it up for us. And that's an important distinction. The Bible tells us Jesus died for us, but the Bible tells us something far more specific than simply that he died for us. The Bible tells us, yes, indeed, he died for us, and that is all important, but that in dying for us, he gave himself for us. And that's not just wordplay. That's important. If all we said was that Jesus died for us, that could mean several things. It could mean that he was simply the victim of uncontrollable and unfortunate events that somehow thrust him into a position and into an outcome that he didn't foresee and didn't want. But nevertheless, there was some benefit accrued to it, us through it. Or if we simply said he died for us, and that's all we said, it could be said that he was nothing but, the subject of an unwitting betrayal by someone else. But that in so doing, there was some benefit to us. Or that he was just caught in the frenzy of insecure people wanting to protect their turf. The Jewish religious leaders, the Roman governors and so forth, simply, he just fell prey to their jealousy. But that there was some benefit to us. If all we say is that Jesus died for us, that could be what somebody takes that to mean. But the Bible, of course, does say that Jesus died for us, but it says that in dying for us, his life was not taken from him, he gave himself for us. And it says it often. In fact, I have to tell you, I was a little surprised this week when I began to think in these terms how often the Bible makes that very point. There's some scriptures going to come up here. Let's read them out loud together. Just phrases of them. Okay? Read it together. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus gave himself to redeem us from every lawless deed. Jesus gave himself as a ransom for all. Jesus, through the eternal Spirit, offered himself without blemish to God. Jesus gave himself for our sins so that he might rescue us from this present evil age. To assert that Jesus gave himself is to assert that he was in control. And we need to understand that. I think all the Gospels in some sense stress this, but John's Gospel especially makes this clear as we begin in chapter 18 to look at his passion narratives. John seems to go out of his way to say, look, Jesus, through all of these events, is absolutely, totally in control. He is directing the events. He's not overtaken, overpowered, victimized, or used. He is giving himself for us. And isn't that exactly what he predicted? You see the verse behind me, John 10:18. No one has taken it from me. That is his life, Jesus said. But I lay it down on my own initiative. And we're going to read in John 19:30 when we get there that Jesus said, "It is finished." And with that, he bowed his head and he gave up his spirit. So you read all of this about the events of his betrayal and his arrest and his trials and his scourgings and the mockings and the crucifixion and his death very differently when you realize that Jesus was in all these things actively giving himself in control of the events, taking matters in hand and giving himself for us. What does it mean that he gave himself for us? Well, in this opening passage in John 18, 1 through 11, I see at least four dynamics of Jesus' death here as he gave himself for us. First, Jesus gave himself for us knowingly. Knowingly. It says there at the very beginning of verse 1, when he had finished praying. That's a little bit of a, well, it's not a little bit, it's a flat out paraphrase. It's kind of an interpretational statement, because really all it says in the Greek text is having said these things. Now that is interpreted by the New International Version to say he's only referring to the prayer that Jesus prayed in chapter 17, and it certainly includes that. But I think probably it has in view the whole discourse he's just delivered to the disciples in the upper room, which covers chapter 14, 15, 16, and 17. And the reason I think I want to emphasize that is that throughout that discourse, and especially it's being ready to be given, that the emphasis is on Jesus knows what's happening here. He's doing what he's doing with knowledge. For example, look at chapter 13, where the evening begins in the upper room with Jesus and his disciples. Chapter 13, in verse 1, it says, "It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father." He knew that. And everything that transpired through that night in that upper room with his disciples was done with knowledge. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Verse 3, "Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God, and that he was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, and got down, and he washed the disciples' feet." Jesus knew what was going on. Even in verse 11 of chapter 13, it says he knew who was going to betray him, and he called out the betrayer, Judas, told him to get on with what he was doing. And so through the whole night, there's this emphasis that Jesus is aware of what's transpiring. And as we transition out of the upper room, out to the garden where he's going to be arrested, again, John puts the emphasis on the fact that Jesus knows what's going on. So chapter 18, verse 1 again, look at that. "When he had finished praying," or having said these things, "Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it." Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" Isn't that interesting? Jesus knew. Jesus knew it all the time. He was aware of what he didn't fall victim to. "Oh, if I'd only known." He was aware from the beginning. And Jesus knowingly went to the place where Judas knew to find him. Jesus knowingly allowed Judas to betray him. He'd already identified him in chapter 13 and said, "Get on with what you're doing." Now, maybe a couple hours later, he's going out to engage Judas to bring this betrayal about. Jesus knowingly went forth to engage his captors. And Jesus knowingly began the dialogue that would end in his arrest. Jesus' knowledge moved him to action. It's interesting. It's translated slightly differently here in the English of the New International Version, but it really the same phrase twice. In verse 1, it says Jesus left with his disciples. Literally, he went out, probably out of the upper room, out of the city, and went out. And then in verse 4, it says he went out, knowing what was going on, he went out perhaps of the garden, or at least out of where they were, to engage the mob and ask them what's going on, who they were. He knew, so he went out. He wasn't overtaken, wasn't secretly spied out, found out, uncovered, and captured. He was the initiator. He gave himself knowingly for us. And the Bible repeatedly makes that distinction and underscores its importance. Listen to this maybe familiar verse to you. Commands us, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author. Right there we could say the initiator, the writer, and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. For the joy set before him, endured the cross. That means Jesus knew what was happening and what it would bring about. And because he knew the other side, he was able to endure the cross. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross. John chapter 12, verse 24, Jesus has said, as we've studied, I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains by itself alone, but if it dies, it produces many seeds. Jesus went to the cross and died knowingly because he anticipated the fruit that his death would bring in the lives of people down through the ages like us, including us. And you say, well, that's great. Jesus knowingly gave himself. So what? Well, I'd like to ask, does he who knew what it would take to purchase you know what it will take to protect you? He knew what it would take to purchase you to be his own. Death on the cross. He could foresee the fruit that would come and see that it included you, and he endured the cross knowing that. He who knew what it would take to purchase you, does he know what it will take to keep you, protect you, preserve you to the very end? Does he know about that stack of bills at home on the desk that just ominously sits there unpaid, glaring at you? Does he know about the depression you've been struggling with lately? Does he know about that temptation you're facing with that person at work? Does he know? Of course he knows. And he who knew what it would take to purchase you knows what it will take to keep you as you walk in trust and faith with him. Jesus knowingly gave himself for us, and he will knowingly give himself to us that we might honor him where we live now. Is there something that God wants you to do? Some step of obedience he wants you to take, and you know what it's going to cost you. At least you have a pretty good idea what it's going to cost you. And you're wavering. You're staggering before the price that obedience will cost. Yours is not the problem that the unforeseen consequences of obedience and what it may bring. Yours is not fear of the unknown. It's crystal clear. Well, it was crystal clear for Jesus. He knew. And he knowingly offered himself for us. Secondly, I know that Jesus gave himself for us powerfully. Now read on, verse 4 again. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, who is it you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. I am he, Jesus said. And Judas, no, this is very important. Interesting that John puts it. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. Not with Jesus and the other disciples, but with the mob and the crowd that he brought there. So set the scene, okay? It's nighttime, of course. And Jesus and the disciples have left the city of Jerusalem. They have gone out from the upper room. They've gone through the city. They've gone out through the gate. They've gone down the Kidron Valley, dropping a couple of hundred feet from the temple, crossing the little stream that's there in certain seasons. And they start back up the slope of the Mount of Olives, of course, probably basically the same path that this mob would take a bit later to find them. And they start up the slope of the Mount of Olives, and somewhere in there they come to probably a walled olive grove. What is the Garden of Gethsemane? It was a full moon. We know that because it was Passover. And it seems likely that it was a clear night, because later on in verse 18 it says it was a cold night, and that means it may have been a high pressure and clear skies. We don't really know, but there's a good chance that there was moonlight to see where you were going. But it says, verse 3, that the mob brought torches and lanterns. They could probably find their way just fine to the garden. So why the lanterns and the torches? Well, I'm guessing that they probably thought they were going to have to do a door-to-door urban warfare search and destroy kind of thing. That Jesus would run, and his disciples would flee, and they'd have to root him out from dark, shadowy corners. And it says they came with weapons. Why did they come with weapons? Well, they probably thought there could be some armed resistance, whether it's from Jesus and his immediate disciples, or whether it was from the crowds that not too long ago had been adoring and worshiping him as he entered Jerusalem. And look at the players that are involved here. We have a detachment of soldiers, it says, that people study the military might of Rome, so that on paper could have been 1,000, probably around 600 strong of men, but it probably wasn't the full detachment, they're guessing, but probably not a few men. Soldiers, hard Roman legions. They come with armor on and weapons in hand. It says some officials from the chief priests are there. The chief priests would have represented the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the layman's conservative Bible movement of the day, are there, meaning that they were representing the Sanhedrin probably, and by officials it probably means temple guards. Those who were charged with making sure things around the temple were especially peaceful. And that would be a heightened sense during a celebration like Passover at this time. And there's Judas. And as I noted before, John goes out of his way in verse 5 to make sure we understand where it was Judas was positioned that night. He was standing with the mob. He was with the temple guards and the Roman soldiers. And Jesus knew who they were looking for, so why did he ask, "Who are you seeking?" Well, he didn't need the information. And there's some speculation about it. Maybe he just wanted to let them know that he was in charge, that he was the initiator, that he came to them and asked the question first to kind of set the table and move the events along. Maybe he was giving them an opportunity just to state their business and forcing them to articulate why it is they're there. Maybe he was baiting them into admitting that they only wanted him, so that a little later he can intercede for the release of his disciples, because they've already said several times, "All we want is you." So maybe that's it. Could have been that. But I think it was to set up exactly what John says happened. Look again at verse 4. He says to them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said, and Judas the traitor was standing there with him. Verse 6. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now that's a pretty veiled description of things. What exactly was that all about? What was happening in that moment? There's various explanations that have been offered. Some say, well, these guys were stressed. It was a busy time, Passover time, lots to do. They had been given a difficult assignment at night. They anticipated the worst. They were going out on a nighttime raid to arrest a public figure that was greatly adored by many of the people just days ago. And when he stepped out of the darkness to initiate the exchange, it scared them, and the guys in front kind of went, oh, like that, and they stumbled back over the guys behind, and they stumbled in the guys behind him, boom, 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 and they went, boom, 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 boom. You know, and Larry, Curly, and Moe, you know, and they kind of, that's the picture that a lot of people paint. You know, they're kind of bumbling idiots. Well, I could be. Others say that what happened was they were just so thrown off guard by the fact that when Jesus identified himself, he did so by using the divine name. Now, it's translated, his answer is translated, I am he. You need to know that in the original text, there is no he. His answer is simply, I am, which, if you've been coursing through John's gospel with us or read it on your own and studied it a bit, you realize it's a very strong theme that runs through John's gospel. This phrase, I am, ego eimi in Greek, is used over and over again. For example, when Jesus says, I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the good shepherd. I am the door of the sheep. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection and the life, and so forth. Through there, he uses this, and he uses it in other places, very significant places, as a significant statement of his deity. He is taking the divine name of God, the holiest covenant name of God, and claiming it for himself. That name that when Moses was at the burning bush on Mount Sinai, and he asked the Lord, if I go and deliver your people from Egypt, and they say, who sent you? What should I say to them? And he says, I am that I am. And from that comes the covenant name of God, Yahweh, or sometimes translated Jehovah. It simply is, I am. The ever-existent, present tense, in all of its fullness and glory, self-existent God of the universe. So, that when Jesus steps forward and says, I am, they're just thrown back because in their contemporary world, you didn't speak that name. You used another name that everybody winked and nodded and knew meant that name because you didn't want to use that name. And by some turn of events, use it lightly or irreverently or vainly and bring the judgment of God upon yourself. And so they were shocked by the fact that he used that name. Kind of a social discomfort. But I think that maybe there was something more than that. He did indeed use that name. But I wonder if maybe when he used that name, there wasn't in some way, and John doesn't say it explicitly, but I wonder if in some way there wasn't some, just momentary breaking out of the glory of who he really was. You know, I just said it was a clear night, but one of those moments where the clouds part and a big beam comes down and the choir goes, oh, was it one of those? And it's this holy divine moment where the veil of his humility was just parted ever so slightly and the lightning bolt of his glory went out momentarily. I love the way F.B. Meyer puts it. He says, when he answered, I am he, what was it that so suddenly affected them? Did some stray beams of concealed glory burst forth from their confinement to indicate his majesty? Was there a direct miracle of divine power which secured their dismay? We cannot tell, but whatever the cause, the crowd suddenly fell back in confusion and they were flung to the ground. He says later, one flash came forth to tell of the sleeping lightning which he would not use. And then, having revealed the might which could have delivered him from their puny arms, he returned to his attitude of self-surrender. Jesus knowingly gave himself for us, but he powerfully gave himself for us. He was in control. And as I studied that, I couldn't help but let my mind kept racing back to the scene with Elijah in 2 Kings chapter 1. It's that amazing story when King Ahab, the king of Israel who chose to worship at pagan altars rather than serve the true God, was so angry with Elijah. He wanted Elijah to be brought down. And so he sent a captain and 50 men out to find Elijah. And they find Elijah sitting up there. And the captain comes up in all of his bluster and says, "Man of God, come down." And Elijah says, "If I am a man of God, let lightning, let fire come down and consume you and your 50. Boom! And the air is filled with the stench of burning hair and flesh. And they're dead. 51 corpses on the ground. Not a fable, not a myth. God did this. Ahab got word of it. He was angrier. He called in another captain and his 50 and said, "Go get Elijah." And they came out and mustered up all of the bluster they could get. And they said, "Man of God, come down." And he said, "If I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. And boom! And there's that stench again. Now there's 102 corpses on the ground. And Ahab hears the word and he's angry again. And he grabs another captain and his 50 and says, "Go get Elijah." And this time, the captain is wiser. And he says, as he comes on his knees, "Man of God, please have respect for my life and the lives of these 50 men, your servants." And Elijah came down and went with them. There's something about that story that I picture here in Jesus. As these men come in their military might and prowess and their religious concoctions and reasons, and they come and they say, you know, "You're coming with us." And Jesus just has to say who he is. "I am." Boom! They're on their backside. And what that must have been like for the Roman soldiers, you know, just in a moment of time, if this is true, if this is how it unfolded. Here are men who serve for the glory of Caesar. And even more than the glory of Caesar, they serve for the collective glory of Rome. And all of a sudden, in a moment, the flash of a half a nanosecond, they behold a beam of glory unlike anything they could have ever conceived. And it threw them back. Or what about the temple guards? Who were charged as Levites to protect the temple grounds where the glory of the Lord was to be found. Where the Shekinah of God was to shine. And here they come doing their business, only to run headlong into that glory and be thrown back. And I wonder what it must have been like for Judas. Now, having once been standing with them, finds himself seated with them. Did he at all think, "What have I done? And what am I doing?" Well, Jesus gave himself for us knowingly and powerfully. But he also gave himself for us sacrificially. As it goes on here, it says in verse 7, again, he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you that I am he," Jesus answered. And apparently, in that exchange, he, you know, as Meyer said, pulled back the lightning that he just for a moment revealed and just simply let his answer stand. I'm here. I'm the one. Jesus answered, "If you're looking for me, then let these men go," referring to his disciples. And why would he do that? Well, verse 11 says this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. "I have not lost one of those that you gave me." He just prayed that in John 17, verse 12. And now he's making sure by his actions that the prayer he prayed to the Father is coming true. But I think it's even more than that. I think that what he's doing here is giving an acted out parable, almost, we might say, in micro fashion of what would happen in actual fact in micro fashion, or macro fashion, the next day on the cross. In the garden at night, he puts himself in the place of the 11 to set them free. Tomorrow, in the light of day, on the cross, he would put himself in the place of not only the 11, but all of us as well, and all of the people of history, that we might go free. He did under the cover of night on a small stage for 11 men what he would do the next day in the light of day on the cross for all people. Jesus gave himself for us sacrificially. He died in my place. He died in your place. He had said in John 15 that very night, greater love have no one than this, but that he laid down his life for his friends in their place. He said over in John chapter 10, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And that's what he's doing. A little over a week ago, we were all kind of keeping our eye on the news about this situation over in the Gulf of Aden, where the U.S. ship had been captured and by Somali pirates, and the pirates, and there was a scuffle and so forth and so on. But in the course of all of that, the captain, Richard Phillips, offered himself to the pirates that he would be their captive, their hostage, if his men, the crew, could go free. And they went for it. And in the course of things, of course, the Somali pirates, four of them, took him into the lifeboat, and they began to take off in the lifeboat. They ran out of gas, and they're adrift there, and the U.S. destroyer shows up, and the U.S. military might comes, and the whole thing transpires. And, of course, Richard Phillips, the captain, was eventually freed. It was interesting, in response to all of these events, that Rear Admiral Richard Guron of the Massachusetts Maritime Academy said this, and it caught my attention. Reminded me as I was thinking of Jesus in the garden this week. Rear Admiral, Massachusetts Maritime Academy, Richard Guron, said of Captain Phillips, he was a good shepherd. He willingly exchanged his life for the lives of his flock, his crew. And that's, of course, what Jesus was doing here for his 11. Physically, literally, he put himself in their place so that they could go free. And the fact is that that's exactly what Jesus did the next day for me and for you, for them on the cross. He put himself where we should have been. The wages of sin is death. And I have earned those wages. And you have too. And Jesus stepped into my place, into your place, and he died. He gave himself up. He delivered his life over so that mine wouldn't have to be taken from me eternally. He paid my price. He died my death and yours as well. And he who knew all that it would cost him left the glories of heaven, came to earth, humbled himself, lived here, perfect life, went to the cross, and died. He did it in my place. And he who had all the power gave himself sacrificially in your place. Instead of you. Which means there's nothing more to be done for it. The death has been died. God is not looking for more against your sins than Jesus has already done. You're not going to supplement it, improve it, augment it. You're not. All you can do is rest in it. Because Jesus gave himself for us sacrificially. And then finally, Jesus gave himself for us submissively. As we come to the last couple of verses here in 10 and 11, I want you to notice that there are two very different personalities at work here, two very different profiles or portraits being painted for us. There's Peter and there is Christ. First Peter, it says, verse 10, that then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Here's Peter. the image I get of Peter as I read him here is, you know, I am not going down without a fight. Peter sees the events converging. He didn't know all this was going to mean. He didn't know how this was going to play out. This wasn't what he pictured. But it's all of a sudden there, and he figures, I'm not getting out alive. I'm taking a bunch of them with me. Maybe he thought he could actually deliver Christ. I don't know. He promised earlier that night, chapter 13, verse 37, that he would die for Christ. But Jesus immediately promised Peter, you will deny me, is what you'll do. And Peter wanted to prove his mettle. He wasn't about to go that way, and so he lashed out. He had zeal without knowledge. And he had zeal without a very good aim either, because all he got was Malchus's ear. I don't know if Malchus ducked or Peter kind of short-armed it or what exactly happened, but all he got was the ear. Pretty tense situation. Remember, this mob coming out here, they're a little geared up. They all took their five-hour energy drink before they came, and they're ready to go. And they're on edge. And so Peter whips out this, and the word there for sword, you know, don't picture this long thing. He's got like maybe a long knife or a short sword. It's not terribly long. In fact, it may, at some occasions, it's used to describe the ceremonial knife used for the Passover lamb being slain. So maybe he had it from then when he was in charge of the meal. We don't really know. But whatever it is, he grabs it and he lashes out, and all of a sudden, you know, the glint of steel and the sound, and all Jesus and Peter and everybody else, and all these swords and spears just right on him. But then, in the middle of that picture, there is the portrait of Christ. Verse 11, Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. He has all power. He has all power, and he says, put your sword away. I don't need your sword, and I don't need you to defend me, Peter, really, I think is what he's saying. He says in Matthew, don't you know that I can call on my Father and this very minute have 12 legions of angels right here? Power is not the problem, Peter. You don't get what's going on. And in fact, Luke, the doctor, makes sure that we understand that he bent over or in some way took the ear and healed Malchus in the garden. But there's more than simply his meekness, his power under control here. Look what he says at the end of verse 11. He says, put away your sword. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? Shall I not drink the cup? Now, John doesn't record the agonizing prayer of Jesus in the garden. He just doesn't include it in the detail as he tells the story. He may well have known it was already in the others and didn't record it here, whatever. He didn't deny that it was there. He just simply doesn't record that. When Jesus again and again cried out three times to the Father, if it is there is any way for this cup to pass from me, let it be. But, Lord, please. So what is the cup? Well, why does he call it a cup? Well, in the Old Testament, the cup was a metaphor. It was a word picture to describe suffering and death. But more than suffering and death, it was a picture also of the wrath of God being poured out. And so what Jesus knew was that the events that I am knowingly walking into, powerfully controlling and directing and giving myself over to and giving myself for, will put me in a place where the cup of the Father, full of his divine and holy wrath against sin, which will demand full payment for the wages of sin, which is death, is going to break upon me for no cause of my own. Now, he prayed through three times, Lord, if there's any way, let it pass from me. And he always ended, nevertheless, not my will be done, but yours be done. But what's he say here about the cup? Whose cup is this? Where did it come from? Who hands it to? The Son? The Father. The perfect Father. The prototypical Father. The Father from whom all lines of fatherhood and definitions of fatherhood are drawn. Gave to his Son the cup that would be the fullest expression of the wrath of God against sin that we could ever know. My sin, your sin, our sin, all sin. He took that and he laid that sin on Christ and he poured out his holy wrath against our sin on his Son. And he says, what do you think? That I shouldn't take this cup from my Father? And he made actual in his actions what he had settled in prayer already. That he had determined, it's not my will, but the Father's will that I want done. He was submissive. He knowingly, powerfully, sacrificially, and submissively gave himself for you and for me. What does all that mean? A couple of applicational points and we're done. First, about salvation truths. What does this mean about our salvation? He who saved me did so thoroughly. There's nothing more to be done. What more could be done? He who saved me did so thoroughly. He who keeps me does so thoroughly. The one who died, the one who rose, the one who was glorified, the one who is seated at the right hand of God, the one who is vested with all authority in heaven and on earth, is just as much in control right now as he was in the garden, as he directed the events of his own death. And I can rest in that. He can keep me. Sanctification truths are growth truths. You know, that the Bible says over and over again, Jesus gave himself for us. But it says a corollary thing. It's a little disconcerting. For example, Ephesians 5:2. We are commanded, walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for you. So, you love like Jesus loved, he says. Okay? Knowingly. Powerfully. Sacrificially. Submissively. Go love somebody that way. And if that's not uncomfortable enough, gentlemen, those of us who are husbands, what does Ephesians 5, verse 25 say? Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Take that authority vested in you as the leader of your home and knowingly put it to work for the blessing and upbuilding of your bride. Take those rights you think you have and lay them aside sacrificially. And submissively take from the Father this ministry of being a husband.